Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I am a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Julian Jackson. Professor Jackson is professor in the Department of History at Queen Mary College at the University of London. He is the author of a good number of well-received books on modern French history and is a winner of the Wolfson Prize and has just received the book prize from the American Library in France. And we will speak today about that particular book titled De Gaulle. Welcome, Professor Jackson.
Thank you very much.
Professor, what made you write this book?
Well, I've, as you said, in your kind introduction, I've been working on his French history all my life, really, and I've done books about many aspects of French history from the 30s, and quite a lot on the occupation, on the fall of France, on 1968. And so I suppose anybody who works on the 20th century in France, as I have, the one person who is, to use the French word, incontournable, that means a person you simply can't avoid. He's there wherever you look, is Charles de Gaulle. He is the dominant figure of 20th century French political history, not just political history. So he's been one of those people I've always felt I wanted to deal with. And I wrote a little biography of him a good 10 years ago or so, but I knew I wanted to do something more substantial. So that's really the first reason. The second reason is that a few years ago at least, de Gaulle's archives became open to the public. They were given after his death to the French National Archives, but then they weren't catalogued and they weren't open, and they became fully open to researchers over the last few years. And so I thought that it would be also an opportunity to revisit him using these archives, which some of which people, not everything in them is new, but they are the first chance to fully go through the de Gaulle archives. And I suppose thirdly, he remains really a person of great contemporary influence, interest, and to at some point influence. So if you just want to take the perspective of a British historian like myself, we, as you know, have just voted to in a referendum 2 years ago to leave the European Community, Brexit and so on, and de Gaulle famously vetoed British application to the what was then the common market. So he's very much in the news as well. And this is also the 60th anniversary in France of the constitution that he created in 1958. So there are lots, and those I think would be the primary main reasons.
Please describe a little bit de Gaulle's family background and how it influenced his future political views.
Well, he was a person actually from a very conservative, very conventional background. He was born in 1890, and so he came from a a sort of minor aristocratic quite background. His father was, or his parents were, only in a lukewarm way Republicans, that is to say, supporters of the Republic, as opposed to monarchists. So when he, in the 1890s in France, monarchism, nostalgia for the monarchy, was still quite, was certainly quite prevalent. And so he came from this slightly conservative family, a bit at odds with France as it had become in the late 19th century, which is partly, I think, why he went into the army, why he decided to become a soldier, because it was a way of serving the nation, serving the country, without necessarily having to implicate yourself in the politics of a regime that his own family didn't hugely admire. So he was a conservative, there's no doubt about that. And he very much had an idea that France needed a strong state. And although he was a pragmatic individual, so he quickly realized as a young man that there's no point in going back to the monarchy, the idea that France needed a strong state was very strong, anchored, I think, in his youth. But then I think even more important, he was born only 20 years after the terrible defeat of France in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-1871. And it was very much still very much scarred families of his generation. So he was brought up in an extraordinarily patriotic, one might even say nationalistic family. At a time also when he was, by the time he was 15, that's 1905, there was quite a strong, what historians have called, a nationalist revival in France, a sense of, you know, new sort of return to the values of nation, church, army, that kind of thing. And so he was very much influenced by that. And I think the one, if there's one thing that everybody needs to know about de Gaulle, and it's actually the title of my book, is that he had, as he said in the first page of his war memoirs, a certain idea of France, which is almost like a kind of almost slightly mystical, romantic idea of France. France had to be a great nation, had to be in the front rank. That was another phrase that he used quite a lot. So I think he inherited both those ideas, the idea of a need for a strong state, but even more the idea of France as a nation that had a world role to play. Another of his key words was grandeur, greatness. So I think those are the things that he takes from his background and his early days and his family.
What influence, if any, did the views of Charles Maurras have on de Gaulle?
Well, that's a massively complicated and still quite controversial question, because Maurras, as you know, was very much an extreme right reactionary figure who at the time of that big conflict in late 19th century France, the Dreyfus Affair, where this Jewish soldier was accused of espionage, which divided France between left and right. And Maurras was very much on the right, anti-Dreyfus, anti-Semitic, in fact, wanting a return to order, stability, the army, and so on. And there's no doubt that de Gaulle's parents, his father, like any conservative of the time, was influenced by or read the ideas of Maurras. And I think there's no doubt that they must have had they were part of the world in which de Gaulle grew up. What's curious is he doesn't very much ever mention Maurras hardly ever mentions Maurras, in fact, in his notebooks or his letters. It's very surprising. And I think actually he was more influenced by another nationalist of the same period, a little bit older, but they were semi-contemporaries, someone called Maurice Barrès, And the difference between, they were both nationalists, Barrès and Maurras. They both believed in, they were both actually anti-Semitic, which I don't think de Gaulle ever really was, actually, unusually for his generation. But the difference between Barrès and Maurras is that Maurras really was a classical reactionary. He wanted to pretend that 150 years of French history had the revolution, that everything that happened since the revolution of 1789 was everything that had gone wrong with France. He wanted to turn the clock back. He wanted, perhaps it was a fantasy, but he wanted to reestablish the monarchy order and that kind of thing. Whereas Barrès, who shared Maurras' nationalism, had a much more what you could call ecumenical, inclusive view of the nation. Barrès said, right, we've had the revolution, we can't pretend it didn't happen, we've got to, as it were, take on board all that's happened in France, in both the kings, but both of the revolution, both the republic and the monarchy. And so I think that if you wanted to find an influence, it would be much more Barrès, who de Gaulle quoted a lot, who had this more inclusive, is the word I'd use, vision of what it was to be French, what it was, what France should be. So I would, like most historians, downplay the influence of Maurras and definitely stress the influence of this other figure of the same sort of period, Barrès.
Did de Gaulle have a good war, as it were, during the Great War? And how did his war experiences influence him in the future?
Well, he had a disappointing war from his point of view, which is to say that, like so many young nationalists of his generation, he was he welcomed the war. It wasn't just in France. He welcomed the war as a chance, well, for revenge over Germany for 1870. And so he was, for him, it was the moment that he'd been waiting for as a young man. And he was, was wounded. So he was within the first day of action, literally at the bridge at Dinant over the River Meuse. He was wounded, and I think he had sort of no more than 5 minutes before he was quite badly wounded, and so was out of action for a few months. Then he was back at the front in the trenches. Then he was wounded again, not too badly in 1915. Then he was back at the front again at the Battle of Verdun, which is obviously the biggest of battles for the French in the First World War. And he was made prisoner. He was captured at Verdun on about a week into the battle. And so, to his eternal regret, he spent the second half of the war, or the period from March 1916 to the end of the First World War, as a prisoner of war. And he tried again and again to escape. There were 7 quite serious escape attempts. But partly he was not an inconspicuous person, and partly it was just very difficult. It wasn't so difficult to escape from a camp, but it was difficult actually to sustain it, as to get to the frontier, to get out, actually to get back to remain at large. So each time he was picked up. So the end of the war was a bit of disappointment for him, in the sense that it was what he'd all his life up to then wanted, which was the victory of France. But then there was also this sense of real sadness. And he talks in a letter about that for the rest of his life, the war will be, the end of the war will be a mixed feelings of obviously glory, but also deep, deep disappointment that he hadn't been able, through no fault of his own, to take a bigger part in it. And also it sets back his promotion, because he ends the war a captain, because for the second 2 years of the war, he's a prisoner of war. So I think it possibly it sharpens his ambition. It's a great sense in the interwar years of wanting to make up for lost time. He says quite explicitly, now everything I do is going to be, I've got to make my mark. I've got to redeem myself. And there was a sense, I wouldn't say it's guilt. He didn't feel guilt. It wasn't his fault. But there was a sense of disappointment, which I think sharpens that sense of a burning ambition to save, to serve France, and to make up for lost time.
What type of personality did de Gaulle have? Was he, in the words of Pierre Mendès-France, timid, in the French meaning of that word?
Yeah, in the French meaning of that word, totally, because the French, just so listeners know, the word timid, because de Gaulle was certainly not a timid person in our sense of the word, but he was timide in the French sense of the word. That's to say, I think he was, which is shy, awkward. He wasn't a person who found it easy to form relationships with people. There was a kind of... to say he was a cold man wouldn't quite be right, because underneath I think he was very passionate, but on the surface he was cutting, curt, impatient, no small talk, extraordinarily aloof, distant. And I think that was partly a kind of shyness to it, but also it was also partly a performance. He was in a kind of way preparing himself to be the leader that he wanted to be, and he had developed a very sort of strong sense of philosophy of leadership. The leader needs to be to keep his distance from the crowd, from other people. He needs to be aloof, slightly distant. He mustn't be too familiar. And so it was partly a performance, but it was also part of his personality. He came from a family that, what I mentioned earlier, they were very much a traditionalist Catholic conservative family. So they weren't the kind of milieu in which people massively express, they weren't expansive in their way they expressed their emotions. But in his case, it was almost there was almost something slightly sort of peculiar about his almost incapacity to express emotion to other people. And perhaps it was linked to, he was a very peculiar looking man. I'm sure everybody knows that he was immensely tall. After all, in France, he was a giant. He was about 6 foot 4, 6 foot five, which in the France of his period made him almost like a freak. And perhaps that added to that sense that he wasn't like other people. So I think that Mendès-France's word that you quote, timide, in the sense of shy, reserved, finding it difficult to relate to other people, is a good description. Yes.
Could de Gaulle be described as intellectual?
He was, I would say, totally, to his absolute figurehead, he was an intellectual. I mean, he was a soldier, so we've said he went into the army, but he was a thinking soldier. He was intensely cerebral, and he was an intellectual. If you want to compare him to say, Winston Churchill, he was an intellectual in the way that Winston Churchill wasn't. Winston Churchill was a sort of magpie. You know, he read a huge amount. He had a brilliant, extraordinary memory. He knew lots of history. He knew lots of literature, but it was all very, all a bit random almost in a way. Whereas de Gaulle was a perfect product of a very classical French education system. He knew all his classics, but he was a voracious reader, and he was really, when he wrote, I mean, one example of this would be in the interwar years, as he was pursuing his career as a soldier, he really made his reputation to some extent as a writer. He published four books in the interwar years. One was a book about the reasons why the Germans lost the First World War, and it's a very cerebral, very dense, short, incisive analysis of the reasons why Germany lost. And his second book is an unbelievably cerebral and stuffed with endless quotations from writers from the classical antiquity right up to, you know, modern contemporary philosophy and the French classics and so on. So he is an intellectual, and all his life he was a voracious reader as well. I would say of literature and history in particular. And he was an intellectual in the sense that when he wrote about history and politics, it was always at a very abstract level, in a very, very dense, highly wrought style of philosophical generalization. So yes, he was an intellectual in uniform, I would say.
What was his relations with Maréchal Pétain in the 1920s?
Well, Pétain had been, it actually so happened that his first posting, his first regiment, Pétain was his colonel before the First World War. That wasn't just pure chance. And Pétain then wasn't the great Pétain that he became as a result of the First World War. But in the interwar years, so Pétain had noticed him as a very able rising young soldier. And then Pétain took him into his, what the French call cabinet, into his sort of private office in 1925. And he took him in for a very specific reason. Pétain was not an intellectual. He was writing a history of the French army. He was writing a history of the French army, partly because he wanted to become a member of the Académie Française. And Pétain knew that he wasn't a great writer, so he knew that there was this rather up and coming young literary soldier, de Gaulle. So de Gaulle was drafted into his cabinet to help him write this book, which de Gaulle rather enjoyed doing. And so Pétain starts out as his patron, really, entirely his sponsor and his patron. But he has a comment that he makes again and again later on, that Pétain, or Marshal Pétain, died in 1925. A rather extraordinary comment, because 1925 is the year that de Gaulle started to work for him. So he wasn't that dead, and he turned out to be a very good patron. But nonetheless, I think what de Gaulle meant by that was that he'd become clear to him that Pétain had begun to ossify intellectually. He was a kind of prisoner of his own myth. And so their relations were, de Gaulle was obviously used him as a patron, but had kind of seen through him in some way, if I could put it that way, that Pétain was a man intellectually limited and very vain, and had become sort of obsessed with his own reputation. And then they quarreled, actually, quite badly, and they quarreled because the book that Pétain had been writing, and that de Gaulle had been kind of ghosting for him, Pétain had kind of put it aside for various reasons. He decided not to go ahead with it, publish it. And so de Gaulle decided he would publish the book under his own name, but told Pétain, well, you know, since you're not going ahead, I'd like to publish this book. And that caused basically a writer's quarrel between the two of him. And in the end, de Gaulle went ahead. And also de Gaulle started to believe that Pétain's ideas about the next war were deeply unimaginative, about the war that was about to come, 1940, were unimaginative and rooted in the past, and so on. So I think what I want to say about de Gaulle is that in 1940, he was one of the few Frenchmen, and this gave him a uniqueness, actually, that allowed him intellectually to kind of emancipate himself, not to believe in
the
myth of Pétain. And that was actually quite liberating, because even politicians of the left, very decent politicians like Léon Blum, they did believe the myth. And de Gaulle was intellectually emancipated from believing the myth. So that was quite liberating, I think. So that's how I would summarize the relationship.
What was de Gaulle's goals in writing his book on the need for a professional army in 1934?
Well, it was a book. It was a complicated book because on one level, everybody thinks rightly that it's partly a book calling for arguing that the next war is going to be different from the last one, and arguing that the war is going to be dominated by speed, by tanks, and that it's necessary to think how to use tanks in an offensively and not just as an accompaniment for the infantry, that they should be, that you should rethink how you fight war. And he wasn't, it really would be quite wrong to say he was the only person who had these ideas. They were ideas, actually, which quite a lot of British writers were developing, and Germans as well. So, but what de Gaulle did was to see that what he did was to find a way of actually making these ideas kind of very accessible. So his wasn't a kind of technical treatise on tanks. It was a kind of plea for rethinking the army, really. But in a way, what the book's also about is to really make the French proud of their army again. It's almost saying that, you know, we're living in an increasingly pacifist, appeasing society. There is going to be, you know, war is a part of human nature. Germany will want her revenge, and we've got to be ready for that. So I actually see the book less as a prophetic and brilliant account of what the next war will be, though it was that. But that's actually, he wasn't the only person to think that, but a book really arguing that if France is to continue to be a significant force in the politics of the world, she needed to rethink her defense strategy.
What was de Gaulle's relations in the 1930s with Paul Reynaud?
Paul Reynaud was the up-and-coming sort of conservative politician of the generation, and really what happened was that Reynaud, who was looking for a cause, really, he was a bit, for complicated reasons, Reynaud's career had kind of slightly stalled because he had taken up unpopular positions on issues like economic policy, and he was arguing for devaluation. So Reynaud therefore took up de Gaulle's ideas on that we were just talking about, on military reform, on tanks. And so basically what happened was that Reynaud became his next patron, his patron after Pétain. And that's what made it possible for de Gaulle to break with Pétain. And de Gaulle was definitely hoping that through Reynaud, who was very much the mouthpiece in Parliament for his political ideas, he would... I think by the end of the 30s, de Gaulle was thinking, you know, that he was thinking Reynaud was his route to becoming Minister of Defense, to being someone who'd really take over the reorganization of the French army. So it was a mutually dependent relationship. It was in the first instance a kind of dependent relationship. De Gaulle saw Reynaud as a conduit to politics, actually, to rethink, to becoming a maker of defense policy. And the dynamics between them gradually shift, and de Gaulle becomes more and more the dominant personality.
Was there a particular, I'm sure there was, date in which, in June 1940, that de Gaulle decided to not go to North Africa, like a lot of other the politicians were going, at least some of them, instead decided to go to England and, in essence, make a break with the coming capitulation?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so much. I mean, the truth was that then no politicians actually really went to North Africa either, though when they did, it was didn't really work out. It was, yeah, there was a particular moment when basically there was a government which was headed by Reynaud, who'd brought de Gaulle into his government in the last days before the armistice was signed with Germany. And Reynaud brought de Gaulle into the government. He made him a Undersecretary of State for Defense, which is a pretty minor post. But nonetheless, it was his first cabinet position, his first government position. And in a sense, it was very important for his future because he was always able to say he wasn't just a soldier, but he'd actually served in the last government of the Third Republic. But yes, it was the day when Reynaud, who wanted or said he wanted to take the government abroad and continue the fight, even if the army in France was defeated. And Rena was outvoted by his own government or resigned because he thought he would be, and Pétain took over. And Pétain took over on the 17th of June, 1940, and his first speech, he says, I'm now going to seek the conditions of an armistice. And for de Gaulle, that was the point which he could not accept. For de Gaulle, although the army had been defeated, France, the French government, France, in some sense, must remain in the war. So on the 17th of June, having been in London the next day, actually, in London the day before, on the 17th of June, he flew to London, which was an extraordinary thing to do, to go into a kind of exile, in fact. He flew to London because he would not accept the armistice. And he flew to London with two suitcases and nothing, really, with a view to hoping originally that other more senior French political figures would follow him and that it might be possible to create a government in exile. But when nobody did, and they all basically rallied to Pétain or went to America or whatever and didn't go to London, at that point de Gaulle found that he was basically alone, and to all intents and purposes, although he couldn't call himself the government because the government was Pétain, he forms what will become a government in exile, and the point of it is to be France in the war.
What was initially Vichy's policy towards de Gaulle in June and July 1940?
There's not much to say. It's very easy to answer. For Vichy, de Gaulle was a traitor, a deserter. He was stripped of his rank and his title. He was always called the ex-General de Gaulle. They saw him as a dissident. Marshal Pétain had signed an armistice with Germany. The war was now, there was an armistice, the war was going to be over, and he was a traitor. And he was indeed in his absence sentenced to, he was court-martialed and sentenced to death. Pétain always said he had never carried it out if he had a chance, but we don't know whether that's true or not. But so no, it's quite simple. Vichy really, really mentioned him, because the danger of mentioning him was to build him up. So although he was technically ex-General de Gaulle, a deserter, a dissident, and a traitor, because he had disobeyed both as a soldier and as a citizen, the Marshal of France, Pétain, he was a non-person, really. He was the enemy. But they didn't make a lot of him because they didn't want to actually give him any particular significance. He was just, as it were, he was cast into outer darkness, really.
On page 143, you write that whether or not to join de Gaulle in 1940 was, quote, more about instinct than calculation, unquote. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, what I mean by that is that de Gaulle, as we've said a bit earlier, de Gaulle was quite a strange person. He wasn't somebody that a lot of people, when they first found, sympathetic. But you're a Frenchman in London, because there were French people in London in 1940 who'd ended up there after Dunkirk, or who were in the French embassy in London, or who decided they wanted to get away from Vichy France. And then there's this man saying, I'm the leader of the Free French. And you've got to think, it sounds almost a bit crazy. This is a man, as I said a moment ago, he arrived with two suitcases. He is a general. We didn't mention before, he's just been appointed general. So he's the most junior general in the French army, who has almost declared himself to be France. So it's an act of faith, really, to believe that. So Frenchmen who wanted to go on fighting, who wanted to do something, there might have been other ways of doing it. The famous French economist, financier Jean Monnet, went to America. He thought, that's the place we've got to go to work on the Roosevelt administration. He thought that London, wasn't the place to be. and other Frenchmen who wanted to go on doing something thought, well, perhaps we should work with the British, perhaps we should actually fight with the British army and so on. So in a way, what de Gaulle was, he had nothing much to offer at the beginning. He was just who he was. The only thing he had to offer is Churchill had, on a whim almost, recognized him as the leader of the Free French. But for a lot of people who then sort of presented themselves to de Gaulle, it was really an act of, I don't know what the, so that you read a quotation from my own book when I said act of faith or impulse, but it was an act of, it was a sort of a gamble. Is this, because a lot of these people at first thought he was pretty odd. Some were impressed by the obvious, extraordinary force of personality, of will, the sheer will and the sheer, and the courage, actually, that it involved, that his choice had involved. So some people were seduced by that. Other people were seduced by the lucidity of his analysis of the situation, because the first speech he made from London, his analysis of the war was the war, the Battle of France has been lost, but that's just the first battle in what will be a world war. The Americans, the British will have behind them, the Allies have behind them the whole weight of their empires, of American industrial power, and so on. And to, in private, he was saying, and probably the Russians will come in on the Allied side in due course. So he had this extraordinary lucidity, prophetic lucidity, intelligence. His reading of the situation was stunning. He turned out to be right, in a sense, if put it that way. So there were reasons. You could be persuaded by him intellectually. You could think, well, there's nothing else to do. He's the only person on offer. But somewhere in it all, I think there was a feeling that it was an almost like an instinctive. It was a gamble that, you know, this man is odd. There's something rather impressive about his force of personality and will. And in the end, it came from, you know, it was as much a moral and an instinctive decision to join him as it was an intellectual and a rational one.
Why did the British not get rid of de Gaulle after the debacle at Dakar in 1940?
They could well have done. I think at that stage, I mean, that's the expedition that was sent to rally the French West Africa to the Free French, which failed because the Vichy forces fired on de Gaulle. They could have been tempted. I think they didn't. They remained loyal to him because, in a way, partly it was Churchill. Churchill felt that he'd made this commitment that he was going to recognize de Gaulle as the leader of the Free French. He felt a certain, obviously at the beginning in particular, a kind of almost a romantic admiration for this figure. So it was partly Churchill, I've said I'm going to back him as leader of the Free French, and I'm going to back him as leader of the Free French. So, but what I think is important is that after Dakar, although they continued to support and back de Gaulle, they do start to slightly recalibrate their relationship to Vichy. And so the Foreign Office starts to think, well, okay, we'll support, you know, Churchill wants to support de Gaulle, but let's see if we can find some channels of working with Vichy and so on. So they're always kind of playing on two registers, and that was accentuated by Dakar. Is it better to work with Vichy and try to bring Vichy into the Allied camp, or is it better to attack Vichy? They tried to tone down de Gaulle's attacks on Vichy after Dakar.
How important was Jean Moulin to de Gaulle?
He becomes the very important. I mean, Moulin was really up to 1941-42. De Gaulle didn't really know much about what was going on with the emerging resistance in France. He didn't really have any. It was very difficult to know what was going on. He had agents who were being parachuted into France, but they didn't really know, and then they didn't really know what to do with this resistance. And when Moulin arrived in London, he arrived in London with a plan, with a strategy. He said, well, look, there are these groups developing. He arrived in October 1941. There are these groups emerging in France, and if you don't organize them, or if somebody doesn't organize them, they will either fall under the influence of communists, or they will just be a kind of unorganized, ramshackle, almost sort of semi-anarchic force. So he offered the goal. He basically said, you know, you want representatives in France, you're parachuting people in, but actually you've got hundreds of people, parachutists, already in place. They're there. What you need to do is to use them. So he gave de Gaulle a strategy for using the resistance, and then was sent back to France to apply that strategy. And because he was a man of extraordinary mixture of, you know, vision, toughness, persuasiveness, he was able to pull together these quite disparate groups who are often quite jealous of each other, and to bring them under the sort of banner of de Gaulle. And there were lots and lots and lots of quarrels. So really, Moulin was vital to de Gaulle's. He really gave him a plan for what to do with the resistance. Of course, if it hadn't been Moulin, probably someone else would have emerged. But Moulin was, because he had been previously a prefect, he was a senior administrator, and so he was someone with whom de Gaulle felt a great affinity. And so I think his role in harnessing the resistance to de Gaulle was very, very important, and gave de Gaulle enormous bargaining power later in his relationship with Roosevelt and Churchill.
What was de Gaulle's relation or view of the post-liberation, what is called in French, purges?
Of the purges, what he wanted was, at times during the war, de Gaulle had started to talk in quite revolutionary terms. You know, he talked about the need for a national insurrection. He talked of he used the word revolution quite a lot. And he was partly doing this to win over the resistance, partly doing it to undercut the attraction of the communists. There were lots of reasons for it. But he kind of, as the liberation gets closer, he starts to slightly backtrack, because what he wants to avoid is he wants to avoid anarchy. He wants order in post-war France, because in his view, that if there's anarchy, this might be a pretext for the Americans and British to set up their own kind of, you know, military government in France. So he's obsessed with the idea of, he wants things to come back. He wants order to be reestablished. He doesn't want there to be a kind of vacuum. And so although he's very clear that those people who have egregiously collaborated need to be punished, the process must be done in an orderly fashion by special courts set up rather than by kind of popular lynchings, because that's the kind of anarchy he disliked. And also it had to be limited, because he was very cynical, but he was right. And he knew that actually there were very few French people who hadn't in some ways implicated themselves in collaboration with the Vichy regime and with the Germans. So, and he said quite explicitly to one of his followers, more left-wing followers in London, Georges Boris, he said, you know, most French were Pétainists, and we've got to work with them after the war if we're going to rebuild France. If we don't use some of these people, we won't have anybody to use. So he felt that the most obviously people who'd most, as it were, blotted their copybook needed to be punished, and this had for symbolic reasons as much as anything else. But he definitely wanted, he wasn't actually bloodthirsty, he was implacable, but he wasn't a sanguinary individual. He actually found it, when he had to decide whether to pardon people or not, he found it something he took very, very seriously, whether or not to do it. So he wanted it done in order. He felt it had to be done, I want to say, in an orderly fashion by the state. There had to be some purges, but they mustn't get out of control. And pragmatically, you had to use people who had compromised themselves with Vichy, or you wouldn't be able to build up the French administration again.
Why did de Gaulle resign as the premier in January 1946?
Well, he was back. So he came back. He was head of a provisional government. There were elections. So parliament was elected. And it was very clear to him that the parliament that was elected was going to set up a constitutional system that he found that was against everything he believed in. He believed in he had developed ideas that one of the problems with France in 1940 had been the weakness of her constitution, the weakness of the president. He had a famous phrase about the president in 1940. He said, the head of state, he said, Lebrun was head of state, but he was no head and there was no state. So he believed that France needed, as I said in almost the first question you asked, a strong state. He believed they were going down a completely wrong path of a much weaker executive system, system with a weak executive, a parliament that could basically sort of bring down governments at a whim. So he felt he could not work with that, and they were going the wrong way. And I think if he resigned because he hoped they'd be so traumatized by his resignation, they'd bring him back to power, and then he could set up the kind of constitutional system he preferred. But unfortunately, they were only too relieved when he actually stood down. And he famously sort of stood at the window one day, saying, looking, where are the crowds calling for me to come back? And there were no crowds calling for him to come back. And so what had been a sort of tactical decision backfired, and he found himself out of power for 12 years. But he would have been incapable of working with the parliament in that system, because he was opposed to, it was entirely against his personality and his beliefs in the need for a strong presidential authority.
What did de Gaulle mean or not mean by his famous statement in Algeria in 1958? I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it. Je vous ai compris.
Yeah, well, that's one of the sort of really famous phrases he uttered. So when he comes back to power in 58, he comes back to power as a result of effectively a kind of coup d'etat, a sort of military coup d'etat in France, in Algiers, where the army in France is in Algiers. The French army is very worried that the politicians are going to give Algeria independence. And so are the Europeans in Algeria. They think that the French government's going to sell them out. So de Gaulle becomes seen by these people as a kind of savior. But de Gaulle probably saw the writing on the wall already. That's to say, probably saw that Algeria would have to become independent. That to resist Algerian independence was simply futile, whatever. He probably did see that. So when he made this famous comment, je vous ai compris, I have understood you, it was a piece of unbelievably brilliant, masterful ambiguity, really, because everybody, he arrived in Algiers after taking power again in 1958 in June. And this huge crowd expectantly waiting, cheering, massive crowd, mainly of people who believe in French Algeria, calling out his name. And so when he says, je vous ai compris, I have understood them. I have understood you. They could all think he'd understood them, but they could all think that he'd understood what they wanted. But actually, if you think about it, he hadn't said anything. He just said, I have understood you. It could mean, yeah, I've understood what you want, but unfortunately, there's not a chance you're going to get it. Or it could have meant, I've understood you and I'm on your side. It was a piece of superb gnomic ambiguity to not give any hostages to fortune to anybody. And then, of course, they become very, very disappointed when they realize, when in fact he ends up introducing policies of which lead eventually to Algerian independence. But so they've been duped, actually, they feel, by this piece of studied ambiguity.
In his book on comparative history of Anglo-French decolonization in the 50s and 60s, Martin Thomas posits that there is a, I wouldn't describe it as racist so much as racialist aspect to de Gaulle's willingness to let Algeria become independent. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I say that explicitly. I actually didn't know he'd said that in the book. I know his book, and I say exactly the same. I see exactly what is being said. What that means is that if you think about it, the idea of people, some people who believed in French Algeria, some of the more idealistic ones, was that they had this, as I say, idealistic idea that Algeria could become fully part of France, that all the Algerian, all the 9 million Muslim North African population would become full French citizens, integrated into France. It's what they called, the term they used was integration. And that's a very noble idea at one level, though the truth was that many of the whites in Algeria said they wouldn't have really wanted that, but it was an idea. It was the idea. It was the noble side of the idea of Algérie Française, French Algeria. And so although at one level we could see de Gaulle as a progressive in the sense that he accepted Algerian or was forced to accept Algerian independence, actually he accepts Algerian independence because he has no truck with this idea of the Algerians as becoming integrated, 9 million Algerians becoming integrated into France. And that's the racist side. He made famous comment I quote in the book, it's been now often quoted to one of his in private, but he sort of said, can you imagine if we had French Algeria, 9 million 9 million Algerians breeding faster than we do, in 50 years time my village, and he lived in a village called Colombe les Églises, Colombe of the two churches, will be Colombe the two mosques, in other words will be overrun by these people. So in that sense, yes, there was, you could say, there was a kind of cynical racism almost to it. So what seems like a progressive, and certainly he was admired by many people on the left for his position that Algeria should become independent, it was tend to be the right who opposed him. Nonetheless, his reasons for it, there is, you could see it as a kind of cynical, conservative, and underneath it a sort of racism. I think that's absolutely the case, yeah.
Why did he regularly meet in the 60s with the pretender, the Comte de Paris?
Yes, I wouldn't want to make too much. I mean, I talked about that in my book because I found those conversations
illuminating,
quite amusing. I found them, I thought they were intriguing. And sometimes quite amusing. And he plays the Comte de Paris, as you say, is the pretender to the French throne. And there hasn't been a French king since 1848. And so you know, this is no longer practical politics. And I think that honestly, somewhere at the back of his mind, de Gaulle was nostalgic for that old France, but we've got to realize that de Gaulle was a utterly pragmatic and quite modernizing conservative. He knew perfectly well that France was not going to become a monarchy again, but there's a little bit of nostalgia there there's a bit of teasing going on. I think he quite liked I think he was almost sort of playing with the pretender, but also he did genuinely see the pretender as the representative of that royal family that had made France what she was, et cetera, et cetera. So he's got very complicated sort of motives. And in the end, I do think he was just playing with him. But of course, what he often said, and this he did say publicly, was that what he had created was a republican monarchy. So he knew perfectly well you couldn't go back to the monarchy. He did know that. He did believe that the style of that in a sort of way that France, there was something in France that was nostalgic for the monarchy, for monarchical authority and so on. And so he quite explicitly said, I have created a monarchie républicaine, a republican monarchy. And he behaved like a monarch, but a republican, an elected monarch. I mean, he was elected. So I don't want to put too much emphasis on those meetings, but I think they tell you something about de Gaulle's sensibility, even if they aren't practical politics, but the meetings you refer to.
Were the events of May 1968 evidence of the failure of the Gaullist modernization project, or per contra, evidence in a sort of a strange way of his success?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, and I think the latter, that they are a kind of way evidence of its success. The 68 was a kind of crisis of modernization. It was France had changed socially massively as a result of the huge economic changes that have been taking place in France since the Second World War, but particularly since the 1960s. And they weren't changes that de Gaulle, you know, personally necessarily implemented, but he approved them because he saw that, you know, economic change was necessary for political power. So he was not against these changes, but they were therefore making a very, very different France. And politically, it was the France that he was running was out of sync, you could say, with these social changes of this massively expanding younger generation that no longer believed in the very conservative family values of the Gaulle generation. They were not Catholic. De Gaulle was Catholic. They were, one might say, more hedonistic. They were, to some extent, products of the consumer society and all that sort of thing. So yes, it was a kind of unpredicted result of the modernization that had been taking place. And a lot of people say, oh, isn't it a sign of De Gaulle's failure that he was out of, that this happened? To which my answer would be, well, I mean, he was by then 79 years old. He'd been president for 10 years, and it's not surprising that this old conservative traditionalist figure, modern in so many ways, couldn't really understand that movement. And of course, another way of framing your question might have been, was 68 a result of the rather authoritarian style of government that de Gaulle had created? So it becomes very difficult in the Fifth Republic to express protest because it's so dominated by the position of de Gaulle. And so in some sense, he was also a victim of that. If you don't allow, or you kind of turn off the usual acts that allow people to express, I mean, let's not exaggerate, it wasn't a dictatorship, it was a democratic regime. He was elected, and there were elections, et cetera, et cetera. There was a free press. But nonetheless, it was a stifling regime, a lot of young people felt. And so 68 was an explosion of that reflected that sense that the young were no longer able, willing, as it were, to be told by this old man who could be their grandfather or their great-grandfather how they should live.
What do you think really occurred on the 29th of May, 1968?
Well, that's the famous day when de Gaulle suddenly disappears from Paris for the day, and no one knows he's gone. Even his own prime minister doesn't know where he's gone. And he secretly goes by helicopter to visit the general in command of the French troops in Germany, stationed in Germany, Baden-Baden. And I talk about this a lot in the book, and in the end, I don't think anyone quite knows. At one level, he clearly went to see the army, the leader of the army, General Massu, to see whether, if this extraordinary popular movement that was 1968 became an attempt to topple the regime, to see if the army would be loyal. At one level, that's clearly what it was about. He was checking up to see whether he could rely on the army. But I think it was a mixture. I think that there was an element that he was possibly wondering whether he should go on. I mean, he was in a state of, he hadn't slept for at least, well, he'd hardly slept for 2.5 weeks, holed up in the Elysee with this movement of popular protest that nobody seemed to be able to control or know where it was going to go. And he was a man of very volatile moods. So he would go from, rather like Churchill, who had these famous, what Churchill used to call his black dog moods, when he'd go into deep depression. And I think some figures like de Gaulle and Churchill almost their energy comes from the sort of, they spring from the despair into which they fall. So he was in a mood of total deep depression on the 29th. But he also was one of those people who was always quite a play actor. So was he as depressed as he said he was? Was he just trying people? Was he sort of almost trying it on? So he would say, it's all over. I'm giving up. Can't go on any longer. And then was he actually waiting for somebody to say, oh, of course you can, the goal doesn't give up, and so on. So it's a very complicated moment where I think his mood was fluctuating from moment to moment. And I think he could, it's not inconceivable he would have resigned after that day, but that seemed to buck him up. He realized the army would back him, and suddenly the mood changed and turned. And I don't think he sort of planned it in that way, but almost the shock of his disappearance and the fact that people were getting fed up with the students rather than getting fed up with the Gilets Jaunes in France today. Hmm. Public mood had changed. And so I think de Gaulle did that at just the right moment, even if he hadn't necessarily planned that.
48 years after his death, what do you think de Gaulle's chief political legacy?
I think
merely legacy.
Yeah, no, legacy. Obviously, I think there are an extraordinary series of achievements, but I think his legacy. I think is to give a new. One perhaps less important is a new inflection to French foreign policy. Which you could say is not a legacy in the sense that it's not necessarily a dominant feature in French politics today. But if the French didn't, for example, go into the Iraq War with the British behind President Bush in 2002, it was partly sort of because of the legacy of de Gaulle's attempt to distance France from America. But I think the real political legacy is the Fifth Republic, which is there today, which has been there for 60 years and is the regime that I think, for all its faults, at the moment people are quite aware of its faults because of the violence going on in France. Macron's having the difficulty. We just mentioned the yellow vest, the Gilets Jaunes movement and so on. But in the end, it's the first political constitution France has had since the French Revolution, which basically has a consensus around it. There's obviously lots of dissent in France at different times. There's lots of opposition to Macron and so on. But Macron is operating in the political system that was created by de Gaulle. And what makes Macron able to exercise the power that he does and to be actually the most powerful political leader in Western Europe, because North America domestically, because the constitution gives him huge power. And it's a constitution which, for all its faults, obviously it has faults, all constitutions have faults, I think has really developed a consensus around it. I think the French, there's sometimes people talk about, we need a new constitution, we need a sixth republic, we need more power to parliament. You get these people saying this from time to time. But in the end, I think the French do, for the first time, think that for all its faults, this regime is the regime that they believe in. They vote in large numbers in the presidential election. So I think to create a consensus around France's political institutions for the first time, really, since the French Revolution, is the legacy. I think it's an outstanding legacy. I'm not saying it's the best system that could be, but is there any system that's perfect? Is the American system perfect? Is the British system perfect? Is the Italian system, German system? No system is perfect. But this is a system which has done the French pretty well for the last 60 years and which has really achieved a consensus. So I'm not sort of arguing that, oh, de Gaulle is the answer to all the problems of French history. But I think that is a considerable legacy in a country which had traditionally a very divided political culture.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
I don't think there is one thing. It's because it's a long book, as I'm sure you know. It's 900 pages almost, and I don't think I want them to. I think they want them to take away. I hope they enjoy it. I tried to make it readable, and it seems to have been much enjoyed by people. It's had a lot of success in United Kingdom in terms of reviews and sales, and it's coming out in France this year. But I think I really would want them to take away that this is an extraordinarily complicated. He is an extraordinarily complicated figure who is really one. I mean, I do think one of the I didn't write it in a kind of hagiographical spirit. I don't think, you know, I think there's lots wrong with him. There's lots I don't find attractive about him, but I think he's an extraordinary. An extraordinary political leader, such as really the 20th century has hardly seen any examples of in any country. That mixture of all the things we've been talking about, this showmanship, cerebrality, if that's the word, intelligence, pragmatism. And so I think what I want to take away is this is a quite extraordinary man. And that the reason the book needs to be so long is that just when you think you've understood him, you realize you haven't understood him, because he's always more complicated than you had thought he was going to be. And he's always one step ahead of you. You think you say this about him. You think you've got to the end, as it were. You've explained him. And then you realize that actually he's a step ahead of you already. So I think that's what I want to bring out, that he is extraordinary and that he merits that his life was a kind of, Napoleon said, you know, what a novel, quel roman que ma vie, what a sort of like a romantic novel my life has been. And I think about de Gaulle, you could say that it's an extraordinary life and he's an extraordinary figure.
Professor Jackson, I would like to thank you very much for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much. Thank you.